Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I'm not even going to go down the rat hole of why and how that is. I think most all of you do know that. And as a matter of fact, as you know, as I look through the portals of, you know, these established news agencies, as I look out my window, I see no sign whatsoever that anything is going to change until you actually start demanding accountability to your and my Constitution. It's that simple. And so until we actually hold government and our public servants accountable, you know, it's kind of like Judgment Day. It's coming, folks. Either we do it or we'll have to wait for the Lord to do it. And then, you know, then you can answer the question why you failed. I know I'm doing everything I can. And with that, we are in the throes of the ratification debates. We're wrapping up. We're on the last two. We're in New York, and then we're going to travel south to North Carolina. I almost said South Carolina, but we've got Paul with us, Paul Venable. And welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
And so any saved ground so far? So what we've been reading, because now we get to see the insights of Matt or Hamilton, and you know how he, I think, underwhelms.
Right. Understood.
Okay.
Okay. No saved rounds. I do want to mention that I really enjoyed your show yesterday. So.
Oh yeah. Yes. My special presidential episodes. You know,
yes.
If I was president, this is what I would do. And mm-hmm. It really exposes, you know, just how far outside the Constitution we are. It really does. But,
right.
You know, it's somebody's got to state the obvious. And you know, it's sad that it's just not that obvious to most people, if you know what I mean. So
It's not just sad, it's stunning. It's stunning. I mean, I surprise audiences with the simple stuff. So it's stunning.
Right.
You know, when I can go to an audience and say, you know, we've got a constitutional crisis in America for two reasons. One, I point my finger at them. You don't know the Constitution. And then I prove it to them. It's stunning. Okay. So, and the second reason is they're elected and appointed oath-bound public officials don't know the Constitution. That's the second part of the crisis. But anyway, that's why we're here, GR.
Right. Absolutely. So as we dive into the New York debates, what we're going to be getting into now, and as a matter of fact, we just really started, folks. In our last episode last week, we basically dove into the New York debates. And now in the New York debates, Hamilton is going to use his political theatrics. But in this particular discourse, he's going to be talking about the addition of states in the union and so forth. And actually, when you really think about this, the expanse of the Union was one necessary. It was actually accounted for in the Constitution, where the Articles of Confederation did not. And more importantly, built into the design of the Constitution was this ability for this constitutional republic to actually evolve out of slavery. And so, and here, this is going to be kind of interesting because I've never heard of the state of Franklin, but he's going to mention it. So go ahead. We're on, I got it on page 23, and it's the very bottom of the page. It's on new states and apportionment. highlight.
All right, we'll get there. Right. So I'm starting at the highlight, right? There is one source.
Yep. That is it.
All right. There's one source of increase also, which does not depend upon any constructions of the Constitution. It is the creation of new states. Vermont, Kentucky, and Franklin will probably become independent. New members of the Union will also be formed from the unsettled tracts of Western Territory. There must be represented and will all contribute to swell the federal legislature. If the whole number of the United States be at present, if the whole number in the United States be at present 3 million, as is commonly supposed, according to the ratio of 1 in every 40,000, we shall have, on the first sentence, census, 100 representatives. In 10 years, 30 more will be added, and in 25 years, the number will double. Then, sir, we shall have 200. If the increase goes on in the same proportion, the Convention of Massachusetts, who made the same objections, have fixed upon this number as the point to which they choose to limit the representation. But can we pronounce with certainty that it will not be expedient to go beyond this number? We cannot. Experience alone must determine. This matter may, with more safety, be left to the direction of the legislature, as it will be the interest of the large increasing states of Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, etc., to augment the representation. Only Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Maryland can be interested in limiting it. We may therefore safely calculate upon a growing representation according to the advance of population and the circumstances of the country.
Okay, so why was he saying that only Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Maryland can be interested in limiting it?
Well, they were the small states.
Yes.
So their representation was not likely to increase at the rate of the larger and growing states and the other territories.
Yes. And actually, that's pretty significant. Because as the newer states were going to come in, and when you look at the, you know, Ohio was one of the first states, Vermont, Maine, and Franklin, he mentions this state, Franklin, up in the very top part, Vermont, Kentucky, and Franklin will probably become independent. And so I have no idea what Franklin is. Maybe that became Maine. But nevertheless, most all of these states that we're looking at were in the mode of not having any desire of slavery.
Right.
So the Senate was going to instantly become, you know, high, well, all things being, true to representation, then we were actually seeing this shift away from slavery. Here's the one thing that most people don't know, because I talk about this in my first book, and go do the research and go do the due diligence, and you will notice that the majority of the midnight judges that Adams appointed were by the recommendation of Mr. Hamilton. And most and most of these judges were in favor of slavery.
Wait a minute. When you say midnight judges, let me see if I understand you correctly. Adams is leaving office, and he's packing the courts with judges.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, that's what you mean by the term midnight judges.
Correct.
But what I don't understand is why Adams would, from Massachusetts, and being a detester of slavery, why he would put these judges in place.
He didn't know. So Adams really was, he wasn't a person, Hamilton was a networker. He got to know people, and he knew, you know, and he didn't hold, you know, those types. Actually, he was one of those maniacal people that probably did hold, you know, the information that he knew about people, you know, as a wedge, but he kept everything to himself, and so he kept his cards really close. He knew these men. Adams didn't. Mm-hmm. Adams may have been a lawyer, and he may have been a Puritan, and he may have been from Massachusetts, but shortly after the, you know, the revolution started, Adams was a ambassador. He just came back. He wasn't even in the States with the when the Constitution was being penned.
And neither was Jefferson.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay.
And right. So Hamilton was here. Hamilton was rubbing elbows with all sorts of people. And so here's a good question. How is it that Martin Van Buren, a lawyer in New York, was successful in his political pursuits? Because he was a pro-slavery lawyer.
Okay, so let's back up just a minute.
Uh-huh.
I don't want you to lose that point, but what motivation would Hamilton from New York have in promoting pro-slavery judges in these midnight appointments?
Okay, so what type of government did Hamilton really want when he left the convention in July? And it looked like they were going down this autonomy and everything else. He scolded everybody. He said that you're creating a mealy-mouthed government that needs more power and more energy. We need to have a permanent king, or, you know, a permanent president, those types of things.
Right.
And he pretty much put it all out on the table where he stood. But
Hamilton was a statist.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Hamilton also understood strategies. He understood political strategies. He understood war strategies. And the best way to conquer is keeping people divided.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the best division of the nation at the time?
It was slavery.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So by allowing... by actually maintaining people that had interests in, you know, maintaining slavery into the courts and those types of things, he knew he was basically going to create this, a permeation of divide and conquer so that the federal government, you know, could actually assume more powers. Because the abolitionists will want the federal government to have more power to end it. And the slaveholders will want the government to have more power to maintain it.
Oh,
the Missouri Compromise was specifically that. A win for the slaveholders, for the federal government to usurp, unconstitutionally take power to be able to maintain and proclaim slavery into states.
So fostering division also fostered this idea of a more powerful central government. It's what we're seeing right now.
Right. Absolutely.
Awful.
It's what we've been seeing throughout the course of this nation. It's always been a divisive war of ideologies, whether the ideology was slavery or whether the ideology was communism, they both stand on the same side. It's statism. It's subjugation of people. Now, in slavery, subjugation only went one way. But but that was actually being broached in the it was like the 1830s. George Fitzhugh was an academic in the South who was actually proclaiming and teaching that all people should be slaves if they don't have affluence, because the poor people in the South were just really, really poor, and they were suffering. They were living miserable lives, and he felt that if they were slaves, they would live and have a much better life.
So I'm sure we could dive into this, to some degree, because that just raises more questions for me. What I mean, why were they poor? Did they have land? You know, if they had an acre, they could grow their own food. But I don't know. And the reason I know that is because I know how to grow my own food on an acre. So, but like I said, I don't want to stray.
Right, right. Okay? That's okay. It's all about Hamilton and what he's trying to say. And he's making a very good point that, you know, there's this interest in the smaller states of limiting and controlling representation and slowing or limiting the growth of the United States. But the bottom line is that they just didn't have enough. I mean, if you look at Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, that was only four states in the Senate. They just didn't possess enough. But but they still had the security in the Constitution that their state maintained an equal voice on all things because the Senate could actually, you know, go one way or the other.
Right. The states had suffrage.
Yeah, that's right.
In Congress.
Equal suffrage. That's right. Okay. So now we go into the next day, and Hamilton then again speaks, and now he speaks on some checks and balances.
Okay, I'm there.
Okay, go ahead.
From the competition that ever subsists between the branches of government, the president will be induced to protect their rights whenever they are invaded by either branch. On whatever side we view this subject, we discover various and powerful checks to the encroachments of Congress. The true and permanent interests of the members are opposed to corruption. The number is vastly too large for easy combination. The rivalship between the houses will forever prove an insuperable obstacle. The people have an obvious and powerful protection in their state governments. Should anything dangerous be attempted, those bodies of perpetual observation will be capable of forming and conducting plans of regular opposition. Can we suppose the people's love of liberty will not, under the incitement of their legislative leaders, be roused into resistance and the madness of tyranny be extinguished at a blow? Sir, the danger is too distant. It is beyond all rational calculations. Unless, of course, you're Hamilton.
Right. Right. So he's really good. Even in the Federalist Papers, you know, when they were talking about the Supreme Court and the federal court usurping the powers, you know, and being instrumental in basically aggrandizing federal powers, you know, he basically used the word, well, that's a phantom. I mean, that doesn't exist. Here are people that their obligation is to protect the Constitution.
Right.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean you can't have people that have, you know, a different opinion in that office. That may be their responsibility, but that doesn't mean that that's what they're going to do.
Right.
Right. Okay, so then, and this is where he actually says it. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to go ahead and highlight the very top part of this because I think it's best to do the whole thing. So go ahead and start off on the phantom with, sir, we hear constantly. Go ahead.
Okay. Sir, we hear constantly a great deal which is rather calculated to awake our passions and create prejudices than to conduct us to the truth and teach us our real interests. I do not suppose this to be the design of the gentleman. Why, then, are we told so often of an aristocracy? For my part, I hardly know. I'm sorry. Is this Hamilton speaking again?
This is still Hamilton, yes.
Forgive me, G.R., I had to chuckle, but I'll catch up. For my part, I hardly know the meaning of this word as it is applied. If all we hear be true, this government is really a very bad one. But who are the aristocracy among us? Where do we find men elevated to a perpetual rank above their fellow citizens and possessing powers entirely independent of them? The arguments of the gentleman only go to prove that there are men who are rich, men who are poor, some who are wise and others who are not, that indeed every distinguished man is an aristocrat. This reminds me of a description of the aristocrats I have seen in a late publication styled The Federal Farmer. The author reckons in the aristocracy, all governors of states, members of Congress, chief magistrates, and all officers of the militia. This description, I presume to say, is ridiculous. The image is a phantom. Does a new government render a rich man more eligible than a poor one? No. It requires no such qualification. It is bottomed on the broad and equal principle of your state constitution. Actually, I love this. Because what he is saying is that America is a classless society. That's what it sounds like he's saying.
And in ways it was, but actually the classes were starting to rise.
Okay.
Because have you ever heard of the Order of the Cincinnati?
I have. I don't know much about it, but I have heard of the Order of the Cincinnati.
Okay. And so who was actually being suited as possibly the president of the Order of Cincinnati?
What I heard was it might be George Washington, but I could be wrong. I don't want to do any disfavor to him.
No, you're absolutely right. So at the time when Madison was trying to save a nation and trying to appeal to Washington to step away from this Order of Cincinnati and, you know, to come back and help save the nation one more time. Because at that point in time, Washington was, you know, he was in the know or in the position to becoming the president of this order. It's like an aristocracy in America. And so as he was, you know, pursuing this, there was a direct conflict because the timing was just perfect to have him pursue this, or he had to step out and say, I got to do this, because they were going to basically anoint whoever the president was. And at that point in time, there was a letter from Knox, because Madison made an appeal to Knox because Knox was a part of this as well. And he said, hey, we need him. And it was Knox's letter that basically says the country needs you. You know, we're seeing the states with after the Shay Rebellion and everything else. We're seeing the states actually being torn apart, and the Union is in grave danger, and so they needed him for the confidence of the nation to kind of follow this evolutionary step of moving from the Articles of Confederation to this new improved government. And that was the whole point of this convention. See, when people tell you that the commission was different, that they were only going to actually fix the Articles of Confederation, they knew they needed a new government, a government that had the authority to tax, the abilities to do very specific things. This was going to be a new government. And Washington finally, you know, basically agreed to do this, and that's really what brought all the states together, because when he said he would attend, boy, I'll tell you what, that news traveled fast.
Yes, it did. Okay, so I got this. I didn't think I knew much about it, but I got this right. Washington was about to be inducted into this Order of the Cincinnati.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So
as the president or whatever the supreme being of the order is, right? The grand poobah. I don't know.
but apparently he was induced instead to unite the nation because he was simply the one person who was able to do it. It sounds to me like after, as a result of all we'd been through, the states were about to fly apart.
You got it. And actually, we just ran out of time. But that perfect assessment. And so as we go into a break, folks, we'll be right back with Hamilton again talking about checks and balances. And so, the history that the ratification debates can provide is just overwhelming. But We'll be right back with more Hamiltonisms after this short promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
So that break seemed to take a bit, and I'm a little bit challenged here with the controls, so forgive me, folks, but... Paul, now that we're back, now that we're ready to move forward, let me, because we're going to get into this thing called checks and balances that Hamilton is going to kind of talk about. Now, here's one of the things that I have a hard time understanding why people don't get this. But as we were going into break, I kind of mentioned, and I've mentioned this before, that when we look at this government that was created by this Constitution, it formed a new form of government. And so it created a literally a new form of government that did not exist anywhere. And so when the Constitution established the order of government, I believe, and so what ended up happening is every state reorganized themselves in alignment to the Constitution so that they, too, maintained that same government. And one of the things that went into this government is this called separations of power, checks and balances.
Right.
So when I talk to people, can a state in the union actually have a magistrate instead of a judiciary, instead of a governor, and instead of a legislative? Can we actually have a state come into the union that would be a magistrate type of state with a parliament, kind of like England was, or Britain was at the time?
I think not, because the Constitution guarantees to every state a republican form of government. Is a magistrate government reflect that?
Well, so it's... No, it doesn't. But the point is, does our county reflect that?
I think maybe no, it doesn't.
You're right. So we don't have a governor at the county level. We don't have the separations of powers.
Right. We don't.
And so checks and balances that were baked into this Constitution for a very specific design of making sure that one body doesn't have too much power. Well, we didn't take to heart when we started reorganizing the states. We didn't take to heart that we needed to do this to the county, because in those days, government was very limited. It could only do certain things. Okay, so I'll let you dive into what he has to say here with checks and balances.
So here's Mr. Hamilton on checks and balances. After all, sir, we must submit to this idea that the true principle of a republic is that the people should choose whom they please to govern them. Representation is imperfect in proportion as the current of popular favor is checked. This great source of free government, popular election, should be perfectly pure and the most unbounded liberty allowed. Where this principle is adhered to, where in the organization of the government, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches are rendered distinct, where again the legislature is divided into separate houses and the operations of each are controlled by various checks and balances, and above all, by the vigilance and weight of the state governments. State or stale? State.
It should be state, right, not stale.
Yeah, yeah. To talk of tyranny and the subversion of our liberties is to speak the language of enthusiasm. This balance between the national and state governments ought to be dwelt on with particular attention, as it is of the utmost importance. It forms a double security to the people. If one encroaches on their rights, they will find a powerful protection in the other. Indeed, they will both be prevented from overpassing their constitutional limits by a certain rivalship, which will ever subsist between them. I am persuaded that a firm union is as necessary to perpetuate our liberties as it is to make us respectable. And experience will probably prove that the national government will be as natural a guardian of our freedom as the state legislature themselves.
Okay, so you may have missed this, but I have to point this out. Mm-hmm. Hamilton has a great way of backhanding people in his comments. And such a backhand was this, is to speak the language of enthusiasm. It's almost like what we say today is calling somebody out as a Karen.
Okay.
Because, you know, a Karen is just somebody that just, you know, loses emotional control and loses all ration and reason. Because what he's basically saying is to talk of tyranny and the subversion of our liberties is to speak the language of enthusiasm.
In other words, you're a Karen, right?
Yes. That's what he's okay. So anyway, so when we really look at why, you know, we need to have this form of government, executive, legislative, and judiciary, is whenever there is power. And so the question is, where should the power be the greatest? If we're going to have government dictate our roadways and our highways and so forth, what government should actually have the most power over us to manage our highway? Do we want some bureaucrat in D.C. to do that? Or do you want somebody at your county seat to basically say, you're going to have, you know, four-way stops? Every intersection is going to have a stoplight.
Well, here's the point. If it's local, you have influence over them. If it's national, your influence is diluted.
Correct. Correct. And so we have the ability to guard ourselves more when we actually allow that. So this, I'm only going down this path to prove that as we start getting the federal government into alignment, we really need to reevaluate not just the state constitution, but establishing county constitutions and allowing the counties to dictate the level, or the people of the counties to dictate the level of government that they want their counties to possess. Mm-hmm. And the design must be that if your county can't possess it, your state can't possess it either. And if the state can't possess it, well, we already know the U.S. Constitution, the federal government can't possess it at all.
Mm-hmm. See, what you're proposing is something that probably got missed in the.
It was, so actually, I'm not going to say it was missed by the framers. I'm right. Going to say that they didn't see the need for it because state and county government was really more of the criminal law and those types of things. Who would have thought that government, the counties, would actually be providing water like ancient Rome did?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't consider, you know, creating a public water system for themselves. They right. didn't consider developing themselves to a point like Rome, because Rome actually did have those types of things. And when all of a sudden, because we know with the vetoes of these basically these bills for the highways, waterways, and so forth, improvements, maintaining, and all of that, that the federal government, or I should say Madison, Monroe, and Jackson, vetoed the federal government's attempts to actually do that. Mm-hmm. See, Rome went out and built roads. They built highways, you know, throughout Europe and even mm-hmm. into Africa and so forth. And so Rome, as a centralized and central controlled government, they took it upon themselves to do that. They said, no, this government is constrained to only these powers. So as we started going down this path and as we started creating state infrastructure, the states actually should have, and then they should have, as counties started getting involved, because how long did it take before public water, utilities, and those types of things became, you know, an everyday occurrence? It was well over 150 years.
Most people drilled their wells.
You know, right. It was over 150 years, because when was the electrical grid envisioned? It was in the 1930s.
You know what? You're right. In fact, I remember my grandfather was telling me, and he was, that he had, that in his neighborhood, the rural Long Island, that all the neighbors had to agree to get electricity so they could put up the poles. And if they had electricity, then they could get the phone lines. Okay. So the grid hadn't been, or maybe had been envisioned. Before then, everyone was pretty much on their own for power or for water.
Right. So there's no doubt that there were certain areas of the United States that were conducive to, you know, creating an infrastructure for themselves.
Well, metro area, sure.
Right, but the concept of the Tennessee Valley Authority of generating electricity and the people in Tennessee to have all the people in Tennessee to have electricity is a completely different story and conversation than the people in New York and New Jersey and those established urban areas. So my point is this, that as we started actually saying, hey, the government can do some pretty cool things for us, we never contained it the way we were supposed to.
Right. I just looked up the Tennessee Valley Authority. It says, is a federally owned electric utility corporation in the United States. I thought it was Tennessee, but it's not. It's owned by the feds. Do we have the authority to do that?
No, they don't. Of course not.
Okay.
But that's what my presidential episodes are for. So moving on, okay. Moving on. Now we go to another checks and balances of Hamilton, because obviously Hamilton spoke, and then Melanchthon Smith spoke, and then Lansing spoke, then Governor Clinton spoke, and apparently they were probably all attacking these concepts of what Madison now had to basically talk about. And so
Hamilton had to talk about?
Correct. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, what Hamilton basically had to redress again. Okay. So he goes into checks and balances, and then the next highlight is going to be on the disunion better. Anyway, okay. So now you can kind of see, because as they're debating, you know, these guys are making arguments to say, you know, this is unfounded. We have the best system. New York was one of those deeply entrenched, I'll just say, cabals mm-hmm. that had no desire to become a part of a new government. So go ahead.
Okay. Sir, the most powerful obstacle to the members of Congress betraying the interest of their constituents is the state legislatures themselves, who will be standing bodies of observation, possessing the confidence of the people, jealous of federal encroachments, and armed with every power to check the first essays of treachery. They will institute regular modes of inquiry. The complicated domestic attachments which subsist between the state legislatures and their electors will ever make them vigilant guardians of the people's rights. possessed of the means and the disposition of resistance, the spirit of opposition will be easily communicated to the people, and under the conduct of an organized body of leaders will act with weight and system. Thus, it appears that the very structure of the Confederacy affords the surest preventives from error and the most powerful checks to misconduct. Did he use Confederacy loosely in this paragraph?
No, I don't think so.
I'm just wondering if he was referring to the Confederacy or if he was referring to the Constitution. But okay. Oh, never mind. I get it. Sir, there is something in an argument that has been urged, which, if it proves anything, concludes all union and all governments. Oh, concludes against all union and all governments. It goes to prove that no power should be entrusted to any body of men because they may be abused. This is an argument of possibility and chance, one that would render useless all reasonings upon the proper operation of things and defeat the established principles of natural and moral causes. It is a species of reasoning sometimes used to excite popular jealousies, but is generally discarded by wise and discerning men. I do not suppose that the honorable member who advanced the idea had any such design. He undoubtedly would not wish to extend his arguments to the destruction of union or government, but this, sir, is its real tendency.
Yes, and so here he's making a very similar argument that, you know, has been made in many of the other states to say, yes, whenever power is delegated, it can be abused, but government has to have these powers. We have to be just watchful of making sure that they don't abuse them. So here's the important part. In these checks and balances, I actually, you don't have it, but I highlighted this while you were reading it, of red. This is all red text now, because what he's really talking about here is interposition. How the states at the very beginning have the authority and the power and the necessary power to interpose upon the federal government if they get outside of the delegated powers. Mm-hmm. And so this is how he says this. He says, sir, the most powerful obstacle to the members of Congress betraying the interests of their constituents is the state legislatures themselves, who will be standing bodies of observation, possessing the confidence of the people, jealous of federal encroachments, and armed with every power to check the first essays of treachery. They will institute regular modes of inquiry. The complicated domestic attachments which subsist between the legislatures and their electors will ever make them vigilant guardians of the people's rights. Mm-hmm. Possessed of the means and the disposition of resistance, the spirit of opposition will be easily communicated to the people, and under the conduct of an organized body of leaders will act with weight and system. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you read this, most people would just glaze over that and not understand that basically he's using the words of interposition.
Mm-hmm.
So this happens to be one of the, you know, I'm not saying that Hamilton didn't contribute, but, you know, this happens to be one of his better, you know, positions that he actually really laid down this whole concept where the states, because this is why he ended that up with the very structure of the Confederacy affords the surest preventions from error. Because we are maintaining a Confederacy because the states still have all that power.
Right.
Right. Okay. So then he goes into, as he continues on, disunion, and actually this disunion is with Governor Clinton.
I see that. It starts with Governor Clinton. Uh-huh, so, right. Governor Clinton, the gentleman has attempted to give an unjust and unnatural coloring to my observations. I am really at a loss to determine whence he draws his inference. I declare that the dissolution of the Union is, of all events, the remotest of my from my wishes. That gentleman may wish for a consolidated, I wish for a federal republic. The object of both of us is a firm, energetic government, and we may both have the good of our country in view, though we disagree as to the means of procuring it. It is not fair reasoning to infer that a man wants no government at all because he attempts to qualify it so as to make it safe and easy. Mr. Hamilton, I only rise to observe that the gentleman has misunderstood me. What I meant to express was this, that if we argued from possibilities only, if we reasoned from chances or an ungovernable propensity to evil instead of taking into view the control which the nature of things or the form of the Constitution provided, the argument would lead us to withdraw all confidence from our fellow citizens and discard the chimerical idea of government. This is true. This is a true deduction from such reasoning. Okay, now, can you unpack this for us?
Can I what?
Unpack this.
Oh, okay. So obviously Clinton took offense and basically stood up and said, I have been injured and, you know, my character or my feelings have been bruised by Hamilton. And and so he basically says the furthest thing I want is disunion. You know, clearly we have to have something, but, you know, obviously he's resisting this government. Then Hamilton comes back and says, you're resisting this because we're talking about the possibilities of things. In other words, we're not actually saying, you know, how this power given is actually going to create tyranny. It is going to be abused. Because as he said earlier, as we actually read that earlier, where he actually talks about, you know, we're just talking, we're going into these things, you're creating arguments against this because of possibilities. Because the concept of abuse is well known to all people that read books of government, that government actually starts abusing its power. Well, so that is no reason, that is not a founded reason to argue against this government. And that's what he's really saying here.
Okay.
Instead of taking into view the control which the nature of things or the form of the Constitution provided. In other words, what controls they actually have, what powers they've been given, which are the necessary powers. And we've seen this a lot, but the point is that Clinton, just like Henry, you know, in contrast, in the Virginia ratification debates, Randolph was a proponent for the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at Clinton, he was not. He was like Patrick Henry, the old governor and the old guard and the creator of the swamp of Virginia. Clinton was the creator of the current swamp of New York.
Okay.
Because most people understand when we talk about swamp, we're talking about bad government. Okay, so now Mr. Lansing, now we go down to Mr. Lansing. And Mr. Lansing, and I think we have just enough time to read this because we've got about 4 minutes left. So go ahead.
Right. Okay, this is encroachments, Mr. Lansing. The states having no constitutional control would soon be found unnecessary and useless and would be gradually extinguished. When this took place, the people would lose their liberties and be reduced from the condition of citizens to that of subjects. It had been remarked that there were more than 2,000 state representatives throughout the Union and that the number of civil and military officers on the state establishment would far exceed those of the United States. And these circumstances, it has been said, would create such an attachment and dependence on the state governments as would give them a superiority over the general government. But, said he, were the states arrayed in all the powers of sovereignty? Could they maintain armies? Had they an unlimited power of taxation? There was no comparison, he said, between the powers of the two governments. The circumstances the gentleman had enumerated, which seemed to be in favor of the states, only proved that the people would be under some advantages to discern the encroachments of Congress and to take the alarm. But what would this signify? The gentleman did not mean that his principles should encourage rebellion. What other resource had they? none but to wait patiently till the long terms of their senators were expired and then elect other men. All the boasted advantages enjoyed by the states were finally reduced to this. The gentleman had spoken of an enmity which would subsist between the general and state governments. What then would be the situation of both? His wish, he said, was to prevent any enmity by giving the states a constitutional and peaceable mode of checking maladministration by recalling their senators and not driving them into hostilities in order to obtain redress.
Okay. And so do the states not have the ability to recall their senators?
Well, they should. I believe before the 17th Amendment, they did.
So let me ask you this. Is it prevented in the Constitution?
No, not that I know of.
Not that, right. So there's nowhere in there that says you can or can't.
Okay.
Correct?
Correct.
Okay, so they're making an argument that says because it's not there, then you can't do it. And that's and that's equally as bad as because it isn't there, then we can do it. And the reality is that the states actually do. And in Article 4 of the Constitution, any state can basically call a person for a crime such as treason and extradite them. It's right there in Article 4 that any person could be charged treason and extradited and returned to the state.
Well, but they don't see that one coming.
No, they didn't. Especially on the terms of recalling. Because one of the things that, you know, is also within the Constitution is this demand that they must support the Constitution. So in other words, the only reason why a state would really have an appropriate recall for a federal servant would be that they failed, they violated their oath of office. Now, the charge would be treason, and they would have to recall them back to the states to try them. But had the Constitution actually had Section 3 of the 14th Amendment when it was written, then it would have been a done deal, because then why else would you want to recall a public servant? Well, so some people, and there are lots of times when people go through, well, you're not doing enough evil for us. You know, we want somebody else in there. Yeah, and so they can't actually, they don't have an argument to stand on other than the fact that if you are actually violating your oath, okay, we're going to remove you, but we want somebody to violate their oath even more. I mean, it does allow anybody to be removed. And so bottom line, folks, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is obviously, so we're out of time, Paul. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was obviously something that was sorely missed. But the point is that the recall feature may not be denied, but it doesn't mean it's not allowed. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we'll be back with more New York debates tomorrow. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.